Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two sponsors for you. Environments for Human have a couple summits coming up. We've been telling you about the SaaS Summit for a couple of weeks now. It's sassummit.com. But, you know, a full day online conference all about the world's most popular CSS preprocessor, SaaS. Save 25% on that one with Shop Talk Show. But since you already know about that one, they have another one coming up just a few weeks after it, the JavaScript Summit. That's jssummit.com, which is probably like their biggest, giantest, most like quintessential Environments for Human Summit. It's a three-day banger, and it's just always like a monster good time. So check out both SaaS Summit, November 6th, and JS Summit, which is, I think, November 18th or 20th. Cool. And lynda.com, L-Y-N-D-A, go to that URL /shoptalk. And if you sign up through that, you get 7 free days, like a week free on Lynda, which is like the world's biggest online learning resource for all this web stuff and photography stuff and business stuff and all kinds of stuff on there. I have a course on there on WordPress theming. Anyway, check it out.
I accidentally hit that button. But let's go. Shopping Maniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end web design development. I'm Dave, gonna cut you off, Rupert. And with me is Chris Coy. Sorry
That'll
about that.
Happen. That'll happen. Fix it in post, you know? That's why we have a professional podcast editor, Aaron Dowd, does good work for us. I'm sure you won't even be able to notice in the final show.
I know.
There is...
I could also just say a string of curse words and he could bleep them out right here. Like bleep, blarp, bleep, 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 bleep.
That was it. You have to actually curse.
Okay. Oh, toot, fart, dingleberry. what a great guy.
PG He's swearing by Dave. There's no guests, no drama, no extensive intros. We've already failed. We're very good at failing about that. The point of these type of shows, and by these type of shows, I mean rapid fire, is that we just do as many question and answers as we can so we can kind of catch up. I don't think we'll ever catch up at this point with the number of questions that we have in the queue, but I need to go through them because there's a lot of them, a lot of them, that are have now fallen under the Shop Talk Show FAQ section. So like we're going to start not answering as many of the like, what should I learn next? And should I go to college or not? And stuff, because those are kind of covered in our FAQ. And people have said like, oh my God, you guys talk about that all the time. Let's talk about something else. And you know what? We like talking about just front end nerdery anyway. So send in your front end nerdery questions. And those are the ones that we really get a kick out of. So that's it. Let's do a question here from Jason Warren.
All right. Jason Warren writes in, for responsive menus, do you use a similar plugin on each site or do you build custom menus for each site? I have been using the Mean Menu jQuery plugin, even on my WordPress sites, and like its functionality. Are there any responsive menu plugins you would recommend?
Okay, that's kind of interesting. I'm going to look up Mean Menu really quick just because it seems like, I wonder how awesome it is, you know? It looks like it's one of those ones where there's like a bar of links across the top, and at a certain breakpoint, it turns into kind of a bar with a three-line menu on the top, and you click that to do the drop-down-y thing. It's like the classic, most quintessential responsive menu ever. I'm actually not even sure why it absolutely has to be JavaScript, just because, I don't know, it doesn't necessarily need to be, but apparently this one is. I don't know. I think what Jason is asking is like, does this work for every single site? Is it good that I use the same approach on every single site? And I would say if it works on every single site, I think you'll know the moment when navigation stops working for you. You know, you'll know when you need to do something differently, but I would say that I wouldn't use something different just for the sake of using something different.
Yeah, it's sort of like if you don't need to change it, don't change it. if it's working for you, it's working for you. I mean, Yeah, you're probably saving yourself a lot of time by just being like, this is how the menu does it, rather than trying to create this new way that this menu does this thing every single time you like work on a website. I was just going to say responsive nav, JS, responsive-nav. That's like a, I'm going to murder his name, but Viljami, JS, that guy. Mm-hmm. Helsinki Device Lab guy. Hey, responsive nav is pretty cool, and it's I think they're doing it was kind of like the hamburger thing, it's very similar, but now it's kind of like an off-canvas thing. So yeah, so
some of these plugins bring with you some UI that mm-hmm. they're used because they have a compelling demo and people are like, wow, that's really cool, I want that on my website, so I'll take it. Because they like how it looks and feels and works and stuff. And that feels pretty legit. But the way that like my mind thinks about this is that what you really need here is probably just a super generic state changer. You need something to literally toggle a class once. You know, like
you need a menu to toggle, or a button that toggles show menu on the body, basically.
Right, like, and maybe not the body, just because maybe there's multiple of them. So probably just its parent element, just so that you're not like opening all the menus on a click or whatever.
Sure, sure.
But I take your point. If you know that there's only one on your entire page, putting a class on the body is kind of nice, because then you can use that class in multiple places in case you need to like nudge something else around or whatever. But that's what you really need. And you don't even need that. I mean, you can use CSS media queries for a lot of it to just change the look and shuffle things around and change how the navigation looks. I mean, imagine what's going on in this little mean demo thing is it's taking these links and it's making, instead of making them inline block or something, it just makes them block instead, which stacks them on top of each other. And they have a little bit of a different background situation to them. And they're like pulled, you know, they probably are absolutely positioned off the top of the page. And then, okay, you did all that with CSS. Now all you need to do is have some kind of little thing that you can click, which is probably already there, but is display none, and then gets display blocked with CSS at a certain size of screen. You attach a JavaScript click handler to that. When you click it, it changes a class on the navigation element, probably. And then instead of them being absolutely positioned off the top of the screen, it pulls them down and it shows, oh, here's the navigation now. So you did most of that, 90% of that with CSS, and then you just needed one little click handler that toggles a class, which is just a line or two of JavaScript with JavaScript. And there's ways that you can even do that with HTML and CSS using like the checkbox hack or whatever, you know, like a label that you click that checks a checkbox, and then you can use the colon checked selector in CSS. I like that. I think that's clever, but it is a little unsemantic, you know, using a form element for toggling the display of things, you know, it's more clever than it's useful. And I think,
yeah, just wrap your whole body in a label. That's that easy. I think they're very, yeah, like you said, it's clever, but I would never give it to a client, the like CSS.
Yeah, one. Probably not. And then, and you may want to approach this with progressive enhancement as well. And by may, I mean should, you know, like maybe there should be some kind of thing happening when you click that menu icon. It has an href that references the ID of the nav element so that like it will, you know, jump
go
you
somewhere.
Yeah. Like maybe you position them at the bottom of the page, and then if JavaScript is active, you add a class that pushes them off the page to the top, you know, that way, you know, that way it works without JavaScript as well. That kind of thing. I mean, this is like a mouth blog post, but I'm sure there's actual blog posts, you know,
mouth blog. No, I think Jason, it's worth, like, it's kind of like write a passage, you know, setting up your own blog, coding out your own responsive menu. I feel like they're very similar.
You're right. It is a write a passage.
I think when mean menu is kind of like not giving you the effect that you want on your website, that would be a good time to change it. So I was just going to say, there's another one, TinyNav.js. Before there was the hamburger, there was the select box as a menu, which I really like. But then I went to a website yesterday with like 500 menu options, and it was the worst thing I've ever seen.
That's true. The select is, I just read a post on that. Somebody wrote a really good post about how they dropped using select menus in a design. And it was just kind of a design case study kind of thing. And it was actually pretty darn interesting. But yeah, I'm not sure that selects are the right thing these days.
It's so tempting because it is like a drop down.
It's accessible.
Right?
You get a lot of UI for free. Yep.
Yeah, but then like when you get into the iPhones and stuff like that, it's just this spinny rotator wheel that is centered aligned text. And dude, it's so hard. It's you know how people like do the dashes for like nesting of links and stuff like that?
How does it handle? I can't picture it in my mind. How does it handle an opt group? I'm sure it can.
I don't know. I think it's maybe just a grayed out little doodad.
Yeah, possibly.
Like a. I don't know.
And then you have to hit done or whatever, or click somewhere else on the page. It's not very, it doesn't say go or anything useful navigationally. It just says like, okay, I'm cool selecting this now. I don't even know what the UI is to close it, but it doesn't feel very satisfying as far as going to another page.
Right. So, alas, it's not perfect.
Alas. We need to say that more. Okay. Good luck, Jason. Mike H. writes in. He says, when editing pre-built WordPress templates for a company I work for, I often find myself using display none to get rid of content that the client doesn't want on the page. Is it possible to overuse this? Yes. Should I be digging deeper into the code to remove these items? We are very busy, and I see this as a style issue, which should be dealt with by using CSS. And it's faster than going through the template files, but it definitely feels like a dirty fix. What are your thoughts on this? So there's like some widgets and stuff in the sidebar, and he's like, I don't want that. Display none. I don't want this footer. Display none.
Yeah, I mean, I maybe disagree that it's a style issue because it's a content issue. I mean, you have extra content widgets on the page that shouldn't be there. I personally would never, I do declare, I would never output a div that would not be used on the page.
That's good. That's like a
That's my mantra. Very... very web standards-y southern gentleman. Can somebody make a web standards southern gentleman?
I need a costume for Halloween, and I might steal that from you because that would be great.
I do declare, micro formats are the future.
You should always have something you can click to jump down the page to navigation.
I do declare, what we are looking at here is an H profile.
I see here you've jumped from an H1 to an H3. That's an abomination.
Your document outline is horrific. Oh, boy. Anyway, I try to never do the display none, display like show block, like the like switcheroos in responsive web design. I try to use all the content just because it's like if you're hiding it, why is it even on the page? That's kind of my thing.
Absolutely.
And then
there
are maybe performance concerns too. Like if you get over 2,000 DOM nodes, like your page will start rendering bad.
I think it feels good to get that off the page. There's like a tingling sensation every time you get to delete something you don't want from a page because you know that's increasing the performance of that page. There's less HTML on the page that the browser has to deal with in style and stuff. And if you're talking about WordPress, there might even be queries associated with that. Like, let's say it's some, you know, news widget or calendar, who knows what. You're like, I don't need the calendar, display none. Well, it's still got to pull all that stuff and run PHP and MySQL to fill it all up with data and to have it never be shown. If you're having a hard time finding the stuff in the templates, it's probably worth like just doing it a couple times so you feel more comfortable with it. It shouldn't be that much harder to go find where it's outputting that and remove it. And you don't even have to just delete it. You could just wrap like server-side comment code around it if you're just looking for like a temporary removal of that thing. That should work pretty well. And then once you know how to do it, that's just as easy as writing a custom CSS selector to hide it. It might even be easier.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, man, you mentioned like the database stuff. Yeah. Like if it's like fetching a calendar, it sounds like your shop is kind of just working like fast and loose and you're like, let's just get it done, you know? Mm-hmm. But, I mean, you got to kind of think of like the next, whatever, isn't it like the responsible developer thinks like, what will the person after me think or something like that? There's some sort of adage about that, but just like, what if somebody jumps into this code base, are they going to get it at all? Or are they just going to be like, oh, he just like, it's like when your mom tells you to clean your room, just like put all your garbage and toys under your bed and you're like done. And it's not done because you have a bunch of garbage under your bed.
Indeed.
I do declare.
Oh, I think it's time for the next question. Let's do a sponsor. We were telling you about the SaaS Summit. We have been telling you about the SaaS Summit. That's going to be pretty great. Coming up November 6th, which is a special day, actually, if you happen to live in Austin, Texas, because it's the world's first CodePen meetup there, which I just found a venue for locked in last night. So it's going to be at the Bungalow, one of those rainy street bars, which should work out pretty good, especially because it's from 6 to 8 p.m., which is like pretty early for rainy street. So it should be like we'll have the place to ourselves kind of thing, I would think. But November 6th is during the daytime. Doesn't have to interfere. You can come to the SaaS Summit. So that's SaaSSummit.com. You know, the CSS preprocessor that everybody talks about and loves and is responsible for making good CSS architecture, good CSS code bases across the internet. If you want to learn more about it, definitely come and learn all about working better with SaaS, SaaS and style guides, streamlining your SaaS, cutting edge SaaS, modular SaaS, responsive layout in SaaS, and then putting it all together at the end should be pretty great. But also, just because we've been telling you so much about that recently, just check out the JS Summit as well, which is coming up November 18th through 20th, which is they're kind of an even bigger thing. It's like 3 days, and it's kind of the biggest, giantest, quintessential must-attend environments for humans summit. You know, it's always like big JavaScript stars talking about stuff. I can't wait. So, if you're more of a JavaScript person, this is the JavaScript event that you can attend anywhere in the world. You know, don't have to buy a hotel, don't have to book flights, don't have to, you know.
It's not already sold out in 37 seconds.
Like, for example.
Like, yeah. JS comps.
Yeah. I've never been to one of those things for that reason. Anyway, yeah.
Like, it can't sell out because it's like online. So it's just add more dinos to your web server.
My gosh, looks awesome. This. I'm not even going to list names. We'll list names next week, but I was like, totally want to go to this. Cool.
Dearest Christopher, this is Web Standard Southern Gentleman. I would like to attend.
I have a proposition for you.
Oh my God, Web Standard Southern Gentleman is killing me. All right, Nick Strawn writes in, I'm trying to develop a horizontally scrolling page layout for a website. Sounds like you'd need JavaScript. Ideally, the user would have about 3 screen widths worth of content to scroll through on a given page. There seems to be some helpful tutorials and suggestions posted on various sites, CSS tricks included, but they are average about 3 to 4 years old. I was wondering how you guys might tackle this sort of challenge these days.
He goes on to talk about a suggestion that I have of how you might approach it with a table layout, which sounds gross, but the idea that I have, so what we're talking about here is horizontally laid out pages, right?
So
against the nature of the web. It goes left to right instead of up to down.
It's Windows 8, not internet, basically, right?
Yeah, right.
Like, I have more to say on that. Go ahead.
Idea was that, like, that you really have to do something weird and unique to get this to work, because you can't just go div, float left. You know, that's not going to work because it'll come to the edge of the page and it'll break. You need something that's going to be like, do not break. So you could be a bunch of divs that you say inline block on, and then maybe do like white space, no wrap on the parent or something. You have to do something tricky to get it to work. I suggested a table, maybe, just because you're, you can go table cell, and they won't wrap. You know, these table cells can be whatever you want in them. That was the only idea. The most important thing you need to consider is the mouse situation, you know? Like, if it's literally only left and right, you probably want the primary, you know, the scroll of your mouse to bring you left and right. And that means you got to hijack the scroll. And there's actually, you know, some pretty simple JavaScript you can do to do that, that should be easy to find and should be able to get to work. And then hopefully swipe still works on it. I imagine it would. But it's kind of, you know, it's weird. You know, you better have kind of a good reason for it. It seems like one of those things that, you know, can be cheesy sometimes. And it's kind of just like, oh, my God. Just the web works the way it does because, you know, of user expectations and stuff. You know, it seems like there's more interesting things you can do than just be like, my website's sideways.
Yeah, I feel like that's the thing. It's like the natural inclination. You're like, hey, what if websites go the other way? And you're like, head explosion, you know.
Well, it's confusing to an old fella like me.
I do declare it should just go vertical. It's similar to web standards, Southern gentlemen. I feel like that nothing beats a tube of content, like rarely ever, you know. And there's been a lot of efforts, like Opera's trying this like figures thing, and they have a demo where you can like trigger pages. You know, iBooks is a good example. You know, they have the page thing, but then they also like switch to like a web format where it's just a vertical tube of content, you know, and which maybe just it's easier to do that, or people are now more comfortable with that. It's kind of weird. Windows 8, the reason I mentioned that is because they actually adopted that horizontal kind of paradigm, because they kind of like enforce, I guess, that screens are 16 by 90. So they have kind of this like letterbox screen, and they kind of enforce horizontal content. I thought it was kind of going to be Jokesville, but it's actually kind of cool. Whenever I pop open my Surface, I'm kind of like, this is cool. It would be cool if it works on the web, but it's super hard on the web. And the main thing, like the red flag that I got from Nick's question was 3 screen widths worth of content, you know? Like in responsive web design, there's no such thing as like a screen width. I mean, you know, is it like 300 pixels, or is it, you know, 320 times 3, or is it 1900 times 3?
Which matters, you know, like, because that also affects the height too, you know, like.
Yeah, because text, when text gets wider,
else
it gets
is
shorter.
Still gonna go up and down, and you and definitely don't want
an
to
image
force
in there,
people to scroll 2 directions.
Right. Yeah, and if there's an image in there, text gets or images get bigger as text gets wider. You know, and so like it just, I think it's you're maybe thinking in a desktop only kind of situation, which is kind of like. You're kind of doing a lot of effort for like a desktop trick, maybe. And that's where it works in like an operating system like Windows, is because they have like enforced device standards, and then they have also pre-rendering kind of situations, like where it'll render before it even, like before the page shows up. It's kind of Ajaxes in the page and calculates how wide it'll be and stuff like that. So, I mean, I could eat my words on this. I mean, it's never caught on the web, which makes me think it's probably just too iffy, you know? Does that, pretty good there?
Too iffy is where we're going to land on that one. And if you really want to do it and you really have good reasons and you're sick of our naysaying, just, you know, just find a way to do it. Make a table, make a, you know, white space, no wrap, you know, screw with the JavaScript, whatever. But just test it. Make sure you're not making an awful experience somewhere else, you know.
Maybe that's a challenge. Everyone goes to CodePen, makes a horizontal scrolling responsive layout, and we say, which one's cool?
Maybe. Like, hey. I mean, I'm okay with that. Just, this is experimentation, and that's what it's for, but I don't know. I also don't want to like encourage it too much.
What if display table? Could you just do that instead of table cells?
Yeah, I think that's in my post too, I think.
Hmm.
Just because then you're just exploiting the layout abilities of tables without having to use them. But it's like, I've always like chuckled at that. It's like, you're just, I don't know. You're just using a table, only you're just pretending it's better because divs. It still has the same source order problems. It just, it brings all the same problems. It's just, oh, it's called div, so it's better now. I don't know.
It is instantly. What if you did like a tube of content, but then rotated everything with like transform?
No.
Transform X or something. Rotate X, and then you're done.
Totally. All just right. Use D3JS and have. Oh, my God.
There we go. All right. Here we go. We've got a question, an audio question, our favorite kind of question here on the Shop Talk Show from Keith Weiland.
Hey, guys. I'm curious if been part of a team where you or someone else on the team introduced a new technology or a process change or maybe like a paradigm shift in how things needed to be done. Maybe something like they were completely new to the idea of a build process or the concept of like HTML templating or maybe using a preprocessor for CSS. And if you've been on a team during transition like that, what were the toughest challenges for the team? Thanks, guys. Really love the show.
All right. Thanks, Keith. Chris?
I can start with my personal anecdote in that it's always been, I have a little bit. I can't recall any like really tough challenges that I've gone through just because I've been very lucky and we've worked with really small teams with really kind of open-minded, malleable people. And it's like, if something needs to change with how we work, we're just kind of like, look, this is better. And I'm like, okay, cool. Let's do it that way now. Or vice versa. They're like, oh, I see what you're doing there. Cool. You know, it's like, it's always been pretty easy. I can't remember any big fights over process or anything like that. Like, for example, switching to a preprocessor, I remember that happening, you know, way back at Wufoo, and we're just like, oh, that's weird, but cool, I got it. Because, you know, what the guy I was working with at the time, Kevin, was just like, all right, we're doing this now. And I was like, oh, I've been meaning to look into that. Looks pretty cool. Okay, now we're doing it, you know?
Yeah. But it almost takes just somebody saying, hey, we're doing this, and you're like, right.
Yeah, hopefully. Okay. And hopefully everybody's like open-minded enough to not be weird about it. Or, you know, and if they disagree, hopefully there's like they can come up with really valid reasons on why they disagree. And then that and their smart reasons that can be talked about and overcame or whatever, or that adjust the idea, you know, just because hopefully you work with like cool people like that. I would think that like when you do client work like you do, that the process gets it gets a little hairier because the process then involves like an X, you know, it involves literally the client as part of that process. And that's like kind of a wild card. So having a defined process is probably a little bit more important. Anyway, I think I hear the word process like attached to client work more so than.
Yeah. I think that's a good distinction. I feel like internal team process, you know, like I can just my small team at Paravel, I can be like, hi, we're using version control from now on. Yeah. And it's maybe like, I don't want to do that or something, but it's like, yep, we're doing, and we use SAS. And you have to, if you ever write JavaScript, you have to JS hint it or whatever. Like those are pretty easy implementations. When you like are doing client stuff and you have to like introduce concepts to an external client, where like right. You don't work there, you have no authority in that. You know, you're just basically.
But they did hire you, and they hired you to do design work, so you do have some say in how you approach that design work, I would think, or you know,
totally. Like you're the consultants, like right. you know, and then there's also in that dynamic, there's also two different things. You know, are you a consultant or are you a contractor? And how they view you, it will change your whole life. Because if you are a consultant, it's like you possess knowledge. If you're a contractor, you are just a grunt worker, like, code this, you. That's how they, that's the difference, sort of.
Imagine if you are Samantha Warren and you're like, I have this new idea. I've been working with you, client, for 6 months. And the way that we've done it in the past is I show you some wireframes, then I show you some full fidelity mockups. And at each point, they get checked off. I want to totally change this process now. I'm thinking that we're going to be able to work faster and better if I show you this new thing that I'm working on called Style Tiles. And it's kind of a combination of wireframes and full fidelity mockups. It lives kind of in between those things, and I just think that this will be a better process for us. Not like that seems better, you, like it might be easy to convince the few people that you work with, but like getting a client on board with that, they may not like understand what you're talking about right away. I can imagine those are the kind of process changes that could be challenging.
I think in my experience, whether it's like you're like saying, hey, we're doing responsive web design now, or hey, we're like doing like style guide driven development, which I'm totally setting up the next question. But if you're like introducing these new concepts there, in my experience, it's like 50-50, like people are like, sure, how's it make my life better? Or they're just like, I don't get it. I don't like it. I guess just tell me what to do or whatever, you know, or like, it's kind of this like 50-50, or there's like people who are really stoked and like, wow, that's actually super useful. I wish I could tell you about this current project, but it is kind of shaking down. It's like there's some people who just aren't totally bought in. And so then you have to kind of do this like politicking kind of stuff. Just not, and that sounds sleazy and grimy, but it's mostly just saying like, here are the benefits, man. Like, I don't know what else, you know, I think we can all talk, like, what do you need? And I'll see if I can get that into the system or into the design or whatever. So, I think that's kind of the thing, is you might have to just kind of, be an advocate.
If Keith is asking what are the toughest challenges, it's you being that advocate. It's like that. It's that education.
It's people. I mean, it's people. Like if you think about our jobs, we make web pages. That's the easy part.
Like,
it's the most childish thing in the world. I mean, it's like we paint with crayons and then we paint with pixels and then we put it up there on the refrigerator and we're like, look how beautiful it is. And then, but like the hardest part about making a website or any product or anything is the people. So I think it's interesting. And when the number of people is smaller, like your internal team, it's easy. But when the number of people is huge, like your client is now involved, it's harder. So I think that's just how it is. So I feel good saying that.
Good. Let's do. I know you are leading us into talking about style guides a little bit, so we'll get into that in a second. But I have our next sponsor is Lynn, and last sponsor. We only have two sponsors per show, guys. I wonder, we never ask how people feel about that, but it feels like a pretty good number. I know some podcasts have like four, and I feel like that's kind of a lot seeming to me. But anyway, total tangent.
We should just make up sponsors. We're sponsored by Taco Bell. Remember that time we were sponsored by Taco Bell?
I think we should. I want to be sponsored by, yes, Taco Bell and a barbecue sauce.
Subway?
Possibly like premium bedding. Maybe like an underwear company, you know, Paul?
Oh, yeah, we'll have to get me undies on the way. Yeah. All right. Well,
anyway, but not, you know, I would never not have an awesome company like lynda.com on sponsoring. Anyway, they, you know, we've told you about them before, but if you want to sign up and get your free 7 days, you should do that at lynda.com/shoptalk. But there are so many courses on here. I was just looking at, you know, on their cool new homepage with the little flippy cards things. They have 459 courses just on photography. So if you want to up your game there, and it's like, you know, I used to have this little gallery section on CSS Tricks where I would like, because I just was like obsessed with taking screenshots of awesome websites I saw, and I still like to do it, but it just was too much work to maintain it for me. I have so many other things going. But like most of the good websites I found that I was screen capped grabbing and putting in my like cool archive gallery was like ones that utilized photography well. It's like kind of a make or break thing on a lot of websites. Is like, did you like clearly take the time to use good photos or even shooting your own photos. You know, it's like it can just take a website from totally mediocre to amazing. Anyway, so it's like upping your photography skills is kind of like upping your web skills too, is my point. But there, if you want to get better at photography, 459 courses on lynda.com from, you know, starting with classics, just like learning to be a better photographer, you know, just learn it. And not to mention just a zillion courses on Photoshop and different techniques there, and just like essential training on Photoshop, straight up. All the way to Photoshop Creative Commons, like the latest Photoshop. Not only just like, here's what it is, but basics, intermediate, advanced courses on Photoshop Creative Cloud. Just like up to date. They have the stuff on Adobe training, which is pretty cool. You know, photography while traveling and lighting equipment and, you know, more esoteric things like photographing a waterfall or using lighting equipment and all that kind of stuff. So much stuff. And that's just photography. Of course, they have stuff on web design and development and stuff too, and business and all kinds of other topics. I have a WordPress course on there. So anyway, whatever. Lynda, lynda.com/shoptalk.
LYNDA.com.
I forgot you invented that. The up the scale.
Yeah, I should have brought in Otis's xylophone for the sponsor ad next time. All right. Well, we got one from Stacy Cavernmo, and this is a very exciting one. Here we go.
Hey, Chris and Dave. This is Stacy from Aurora, Illinois. I started out my process with style guides by going to the site stylifyme.com, and you enter in the URL of a site, and it displays the colors and fonts that you've used on the site, some image dimensions and spacing or whatnot. However, I was very shocked to see how many different blues I actually did use, and I know that's easy to do when you're using SAS and you are maybe a little too addicted to color functions, but it's so easy. So then I started looking more into developing a full style guide that would allow us as a team to build out modules of code that can be reused in other areas, working from an element collage as opposed to a full PSD mockup. Well, I could probably ramble on for days about style guides, but I just wanted to call and share my story and tell you guys that I love your podcast and keep up the great work. Thanks. Bye.
I've never heard element collage before. I kind of like that, you know? It's kind of like a more fun version of a style guide kind of thing. An element collage. Yeah. But Stacy, we asked a couple of episodes if people would send in a audio question about how they use style guides and stuff, like maybe 3-4 episodes ago when we were telling you about the Environments for Humans SAS Summit. And we almost forgot about it because not very many people did. But Stacy did, so you win, Stacy. We'll send you the free ticket to the SAS Summit coming up November 6th. And thanks for that. Do you have any thoughts on that stuff, Dave?
Oh, I just thought it was cool. The colors thing is the perfect thing. I installed this colors plugin in my Atom editor. Like it shows or highlights the color, the hex as a color. And man,
really?
I
want that.
So good. You need one. You need one.
So and every time it shows you the color, like the code for the color, it's in that color?
Yeah, like the background is that color, and then they
pick white or black
the text. Yeah.
What?
Oh, so good. And what the thing, and it's like you're just like cruising through your SAS file, and you're like, dude, this is clown town because it's 800 different colors. This is ridiculous. I have technical debt. And I think that's exactly what she described. Was just like, I have too many colors. I'm not sure if it works really well.
But at least she's saying in SAS, she's saying that they're using color functions. So at least it's based off of one blue, but then maybe it's darkened or lightened or whatever the other functions are.
Like you have 5, 10, 8, 9, 7%, you know, and like it's like, just use one, like pull all your colors and all your color functions into a variable file. And now you have like a vision of how everything works. So
yeah,
I thought it was super cool. That's cool. That's cool to me.
Okay.
Beep, blarp, bleep. All right. Thanks so much, Stacy, for calling in and winning. So you win. You're a winner. All right. Next question is another audio question from Mr. Poopsplat himself, Matt Soria. Writes in, calls in, actually, and says,
Hey guys, Matt here. Love your show. I have a very specific question, so I'm going to try and explain it as thoroughly as possible. Okay, so I'm doing a site, and on the site we've got a banner, and just for ease of description, let's just call it a logo. And they're near each other, but they're independent, and the logo is interactive. When you hover on it, it moves. You can click it to go back to the top, whatever. The banner is just the banner. It's just purely visual. So to have some fun, we are going to have a different background image load up on every refresh of the page or every visit of the page, so that there's a different background image on the banner and also on the logo. So the background images for each correspond to each other. And again, for ease of visualization, let's just pretend the banner background image is of a dog's body, and okay. The background image for the logo is of the dog's head. And we also have a set of corresponding background images where it's a cow's body, and the logo is a cow's head. So on each page load, we want to randomly generate a background image from an array of background images for each of these elements, the logo and the banner, but they need to be corresponding, which is the challenge. Now, I've used what you've posted on a snippet on CSS Tricks to generate a random background image, and that works fine. And I've used Matt Mullenweg's random image script, which I think is essentially the same thing. And that works great, but it only helps to generate one background image somewhere. And I can apply that to both the logo and the banner, but they'll be independently randomly generated. And my issue is I need them to be generated correspondingly. I don't really want like the dog's head on the cow's body. So my question is, have you ever had a situation where you needed to do something like this? I can't really think of many that you do. It's kind of silly, but
I think we get the gist of it.
If you have,
yeah. All right, thanks, Matt.
I'm sure we have the written question in front of us too, so we can kind of verify that was kind of the end of the deal. It's talking about randomizing, but in corresponding. What you could, you need something that is possible to do random in, and you can do random in Sass, but Sass just only compiles one. So that's not going to help you on every page refresh. So you're looking at needing to do random in something like a server-side language like PHP or JavaScript. And what you need to do then is like probably have an array, like an array of arrays. So one array is both is both banner1.png and logo1.png. And the second array is banner2.png and logo2.png. And then you randomly pick one of those, and what you get out of it is an array that has both of those file names in it. And then you plug them both in, You just need to have like not an associative array, but just like an array of arrays, I think would do it for you. Mm-hmm. Or just randomly generate the number one or the number two, or like just generate a random array number links of between 1 through 10 and then use that in the file name. That's probably even easier to use if you've named them correct, with really dash integer. Then just generate a random number and use it that way. Now, the problem with this is that it's not particularly cacheable, right? I mean, even if you do it on a server-side language, if you cache that HTML page somehow, you only ever get the one, until that cache is broken. So it might be smart to have HTML caching on, but use, JavaScript to drop in anything. But then the problem with that is that there's no fallback if JavaScript doesn't work, because you definitely don't want something in there and then have JavaScript replace it quick, because then you're downloading two assets when you only needed one. So it's actually kind of like there's lots of considerations for this that's weird. If you're not using HTML caching of any kind, you can just generate the random number in PHP or whatever server-side thing you're doing. And that should work fine. Mm-hmm. Do you have any other ideas, Dave?
No, I think that's it. I think, it's just taking a step back from what you're trying. Like, you get these like random image scripts, and you're like, okay, so there's like a list of six images, and it just selects one, and you just have to take a step back and be like, how can I make this script just select an array from an array of arrays? And that's where, like, that's where computer science starts getting hard. That's basically, you've unlocked the mystery of computer science, how to make arrays do crap. So, yeah, then you're just like, you always put the logo in the first slot in the, then in, like, so it's zero, or you could call it logo, you know, arrow blaster, whatever the URL of the logo. And then the second one is your background. So it takes a little bit of work. But I remember being at this point where you had to like do your brain and like figure out, oh, I need to select an array of things rather than, yeah. And it gets a little trickier syntactically with JavaScript, when you're doing that on the front end. But like Chris said, it's totally possible. You just have to, you know, and I would also go like rather, yeah, just, yeah, you just count, you just say like random array dot length, basically, right? That's how easy it would be.
Yeah, I mean, I forget how you do it. I have to look it up every time in JavaScript because it's like math dot round dot math dot random plus
math dot rand parens times. Oh wait, math dot floor.
Yeah, floor.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, it's one of those things where you just look it up every time and it's no big deal, you know? And then you have to multiply it because it usually times generates between length. 0 and 1 is the random it comes up with, and then mm-hmm. you just multiply it, yeah.
It's an interesting way to do that. It's just interesting to me, so. All right, well, hopefully that helped, huh? I think we got it. All right, next question comes from Eric Ellenbrook. As a beginner developer, I find it hard to come up with projects for myself. I've made a portfolio, done a few websites for friends, companies. However, I'm looking to do more. What do you suggest a beginner do in order to continue not only learning but implementing new ideas?
How does
a beginner
stay qualify as an FAQ kind of thing, like, I need more in my portfolio, but I don't have the opportunities to put stuff in my portfolio or kind of, right? Or it's just like, I need more work to do. How can I get that work?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a mix of
just build websites!
And, I don't know, maybe get into a band. That would be the best way. I think that's how most of us did it, is you were in a band at some point.
Right. You know, work on your personal site, but it sounds like that. You've made a portfolio, so it sounds like, and you've worked on a few friends' websites. That's cool. Some people really do thrive on the motivation of building something that's kind of real, that's really going to be used. But mm-hmm. I don't know that they necessarily always have to be. Maybe you could just, maybe you have a little idea. Maybe you have a quote that you really like. Maybe you have a thought that continually pops into your head. Maybe you have a movie that you really like or a video game that you really like. I mean, think of Paravel and their many faces of thing. You just liked movies. So you're like, let's build some crazy ass websites around movies, you know? Nobody
literally made a website about Alan Rickman. So.
Think of that, or think of how many websites you see a day that suck, you know, that you're like, this just needs a better design. It needs better UX. It needs better, you know, information architecture or whatever. You could just take a stab at it. Be like, I'm just going to redesign this one. It doesn't even necessarily have to be live. It could just be an exercise in what you needed to do. Or if you think it really is way, way better, then maybe you could make it and then approach that company and be like, I know I don't have like the full information about your company and its needs or whatever, but I did this and, you know, I'll sell it to you, or you can have it if you don't care or whatever. But I just think of how many opportunities there are how many ideas there are in the world for opportunities there are to make better websites where there's are sucky ones. You know, there's just no shortage of, I think it's weird when people are just like, I want to make websites, but there aren't any to make. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about Brad Frost. He's doing that Pittsburgh Food Bank website. And he and his wife Melissa are kind of designing it out in the open, and they've actually launched it. And you can kind of see. I mean, to be fair, like Brad is probably using this in fodder for talks about, you know, web design and stuff like that. But he was actually motivated by the fact that, dude, this is the food bank, and it has just a garbage website that's really, really hard to use, really, really hard to donate to. So we're just going to volunteer time and effort and make it better, you know, and then they have a portfolio piece, and then they have, something to talk about at conferences. So I'm not saying like just give away web design, because that actually doesn't really help our industry. But it's also like, you know, if you just know this company's not valuing it and you value it, maybe you do offer it or something. But I think, you know, you could also look at, it depends on how old you are, but you could also look at, you know, getting a job or I don't know, just talking at meetups and giving a talk is a really good way to stay busy, because then you're like, you're sweating bullets that you're going to mess up. And so you actually work really hard on your craft and you start whatever, learning new things just in case somebody asks a question that's like the next level and you actually don't know about it. So it's kind of using your whatever imposter syndrome to get better. So giving a talk would be great.
Yeah. Cool.
All right. Pew. Next question actually comes from a friend of mine. Maggie Jasinski calls in.
Hey guys, I've been implementing Ajax on my Rails 4 site with jQuery's $.load function and using window.history.pushdate to update URLs in the browser's address form. I'm having issues with the page staying the same when I use the back button. The URL responds correctly in the address bar. However, the page does not go back to its previous state. I've read about a few JavaScript libraries being able to deal with this. What are y'all's thoughts on the subject?
This is good. This is heading into kind of classic, how do I Ajax pages in?
I think
in?
We even talked about it a little bit last episode.
Yeah. So, do you have any thoughts? The technology stack here. Okay, so Maggie's problem is she wants, like, the page to stay the same when using the back button.
No, you
like,
want the window to not stay the same. Or the problem is that it is staying the same, right?
It is staying the same. So it wants to manage state kind of all the way through, right? So it does not go back to its previous state. I guess this is like the Rails 4 thing makes me think Ember is the right option.
Well,
right?
Before we jump to a framework-y kind of thing, push state, all that does is push state adds a new URL to the browser history kind of thing. So if you're at, you know, website.com/about and you click a link and you do Ajax stuff to replace the content on the page, but you want to change the URL as well, you use window.history.pushstate to say, okay, now you're not at /about anymore, you're at /contact or whatever. It literally changes the URL in the URL bar, which only in this new world of HTML5 can that happen without triggering a full page refresh. So that's what's happening there, that you are able to change the URL up in the bar. But now, because you used push state instead of replace state, that's good usually. Just you only use replace state if, like, I don't know, you're really sure that you want to break the back button, you know. But push state adds it to the history. So now when you click the back button, it will take you back to /about. But all you're doing there is pushing another state. But you didn't, you know, change the content well, you know. Like, if you click the back button and go back, it's like, how does the browser, your application isn't, like, responding to that event. And I think it's the pop state event, right? It's like you need to not just be pushing state all the time, but also listening for changes to that URL that happen some other way, and that some other way is almost surely the back button in the browser. So that URL changes and it goes back from contact now back to about again, you need to listen for that event and then do the same type of thing that you would have if a link was clicked. You need to go grab that information and plop it down on the page or whatever. So architecturally, that's what you need to be doing.
Oh, interesting. So can you hijack the back button basically? Like E prevent default? Sort of?
Well, I think you just let it happen. You don't prevent it. You just let the back button be clicked. The URL changes again. But now the URL's changed. That's an event that fires. You need to listen for that event and then look at the URL and decide what you're going to do with that URL change. Mm. And I think it's pop state. Reading from the MDN is, a pop state event is dispatched to the window every time the active history changes. Oh, maybe that's not the right one then, because that would fire when you do a push state as well, then I would think. if the history entry being activated was created by a call to push state, the pop state event contains a copy of the history system. So you can tell if it was activated by a push state or a replace state, but it probably also fires on a back button press. So that probably is the event you need to watch for. You just need to make sure that you're, you know, filtering out calls to it that happen on a push state. It sounds like you can get this done. But what were you going to say about using framework stuff?
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of effort because now you're going to have to kind of duplicate your model view and controller thing. The people who brought you Rails, Yehuda Katz, are now working on Ember, which is kind of the tie-in front-end framework. And Ember works with anything, really, but it's really kind of seeking parity with Rails, like feature parity. So, it's going to be a whole other thing you'll have to learn, but I think that would kind of be the best. That's kind of the next state for you to kind of check out, I think, is to get into a kind of framework to manage this front and back stuff, because it is hard. And I think that's why people don't do it that much. You know, I think we've gotten quite a few questions like, how do I keep an audio thing playing on my page? And then, like when I hit the back button or navigate to another page, the audio keeps playing. It's like, well, now you're getting into push state, you know, PJAX or this stuff. It's tough. Managing state is super, super hard. But thankfully, these frameworks like Backbone and Ember and Angular and all that kind of help manage that for you.
So. Yeah, indeed, they do.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's kind of, I think I've tried to do this kind of on my own with, like, you know, what was it? jQuery barbecue or whatever, back button, whatever.
Oh yeah, better back, better, yeah, something.
BBQ history or something. And I was using that and I thought, like, yeah, I got it. And then I didn't. So I think it's tough. So good luck, Maggie. Yeah. All right. Next question. Also, you're my friend, so you can just ask me anytime. Neil McCauley writes in, we're considering moving a WordPress site with a few hundred posts and growing over to something from a static site generator like Jekyll. So over to Jekyll, WordPress to Jekyll. Wondering how scalable that is. Is there a limit? Do things slow down? Twitter suggestions even include something like Drupal to generate something essentially static. And there's a bit.ly link here. But Dave moved his WordPress presence to a Jekyll generated one? ? Are your thoughts, Chris? You just did a Jekyll site.
Yeah, but I didn't move it. You know, I just built one. Oh. There are, looks like in the Jekyll docs, there are importers from things. I'm not sure how it works exactly. Do you think it looked, it does. It works how you might expect it to. Like, it's a Ruby gem called Jekyll import, and one of the things that it's able to run in Ruby is a WordPress thing, and you have to give it database information. So you give it, you know, your database has to be local or presumably local, or maybe it's able to hook up to a database, you know, another server.
I use, sure, like the WordPress XML thing.
Oh, have you? Well, it looks like the modern version of it just looks through the database, but there, maybe there is a way to do it with just the exporter. But you think the database has like more stuff in it? I mean, it has everything. So whatever they need,
it's going to have your custom post types and stuff. Yeah. It's going to be way better. Okay, I had problems. That's why I was going to. I had to do some manual work from the XML. So I don't necessarily think it's hot dogs.
There you go. Maybe that was the old way, because I mean, Jekyll does, you know, it stays pretty updated. The idea though is Jekyll is every blog post is literally a markdown file with a date and a name in the file name, and pages are named similarly, you know, but they'll be in a different folder probably. So this is going to run, look through your database and make a flat file for every single post that it finds in the database. So this is, you know, somebody put some effort into this. This was a complicated thing to build probably. And then you're on Jekyll, you know, then you can use that data to build Jekyll. And Jekyll is super manual, you know, like you're going to have to, there's going to be a learning curve to it. You're going to have to figure out how this stuff works. It's not that bad, but it's definitely like not as simple. There's like literally zero UI to Jekyll. It's just a Jekyll build and hopefully that works. And if it doesn't, you better look up why, you know? Anyway, and then it says, is there a limit? No, I doubt it. I think Jekyll could probably run on just about anything, you know, like maybe like the, and then it says, do things slow down? Your website won't slow down because, you know, there's no limit to how big a website full of flat files can be. It's going to be equally fast no matter what, which is one of the advantages of being Jekyll. But how fast Jekyll build takes to run probably will matter how many pages you have. If you have 10,000 pages, that's certainly going to be slower than 10 pages. And I don't know what the limit is. At what point is Jekyll build prohibitively slow? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. You know what? I had a situation where I was using Jekyll with node modules and all this, you know, gulping my Jekyll and all this stuff. And it was like taking 10 seconds to compile the whole website, which is kind of a long time when you're trying to like live edit and update. This is on the local setup, right? And what we noticed was it was trying to copy over your, like when it generates the site, it was trying to generate out like 17 megabytes of node modules, which is like 1200 files or something, you know, it's node. So it's like ridiculous. So, there's like this, I guess dependency kind of issue. So if you throw the more files you throw at it, the more it has to do. And there's probably logarithmic scale of how slow it'll start getting. So that's something to consider. Like, is your website going to be a million pages long? You know, like maybe WordPress is actually better for that sort of thing. Me, I write 5 blog posts a year. so Jekyll is suiting my needs and my overhead.
It's
just
nice
fine.
To know that it's actively updated, right? If Jekyll hasn't been touched in 2 years, that might be start to feel kind of weird, wouldn't it?
Right. And like the GitHub integration is wonderful because I can just, I mean, you can throw it up on a GH Pages branch and it compiles itself. It's
beautiful.
Do you
host on GitHub Pages?
I have before. So the accessibility project, A11Y project, yeah. Is all.
I'm kind of like, why not? Like, that's what we did.
Why not?
The site I worked on. It's, you get to use free hosting that is super duper robust.
Yeah. Yes. No, I mean, it's why wouldn't you? All these like dumb little projects I do, I call them dumb projects, but jQuery plugins or, you know, app, you know, like Goodfoot. I used to do an iPhone app, and Heroku just emailed me and it's like, you need to upgrade your Rails setup, you know, or whatever. Cause I use Rails to generate one page.
3 years ago. Yeah.
3 years ago. Yeah. And so, it's like, well, that's probably going to just move to a GitHub repo, like open source sort of thing, you know, because I really don't care, you know, that's the thing. So, yeah, I mean, yeah. If people can view source, I should probably move my blog to open, like to whatchamacallit. But
what's cool about it is that it does a build and that you can keep your site folder out of the repo then, which is kind of nice. You don't have to, and your .css stuff and all that, because it runs that stuff too. So it's kind of like, it really makes it for a really clean repo.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I guess watch your node modules folder. I could probably do a blog post on like what I'm ignoring. Yeah, I could tell you right now what I'm ignoring. Because in my config YAML, I said, don't ever mess with the node modules folder and the SAS folder. Like I am using gulp to compile the SAS, even though now I guess Jekyll can do that. Cause it was just like, I was getting like a recursion. So you have to kind of watch for that. Mm-hmm. Like if your gulp compiles your SAS and then your Ruby says, oh, there's been a change, I'm going to go update that. And then it just kind of, it's a redundancy that doesn't need to happen. And it's, yeah. So anyway, yeah, it's good. And then I was using like Jekyll Watch and but now I'm just doing like Jekyll Build. Yeah. Yeah. I made a gulp task for Jekyll to like just watch for HTML changes or whatever.
Oh, right.
And then when I hit that, then I do.
Yeah. That's how I did too. I used a build tool instead of Jekyll Watch. Just because then you can everything's in one place. All your SAS watching and JavaScript watching and HTML watching and stuff is all configured in one place. And I kind of like that. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe Jekyll can do that now too. I'm not sure.
We probably over-answered your question.
Yeah, but you're fine. If you're looking to switch from WordPress to Jekyll, you can totally do that. They even have an official plugin to do that for you. It's like a Ruby script you run on your database. So you'll be fine.
Yeah, I think hundreds of posts is probably fine because it's just text. Yeah. But you may have to do some tricks in your tooling to make it, you know, like there's a way you can make Jekyll only build the post you're working on and stuff like that. So that may be something you'll have to look at doing. So, and then I don't know, maybe some people can comment, are you using Jekyll and like where is it maxing out? But I mean, dude, there's people who use it for hundreds and thousands of posts. So, I mean, I think you'll be fine for at least the next 5 years. And then you'll want to redo your website anyway. So, viz-a-viz. All right. I think we're going to call it quits for this edition of the Shop Talk Show. Thank you for downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to vote us up, share, tweet. We're at Shop Talk Show on Twitter. Christopher, you got anything? I do declare, Mr. Christopher.
I believe that wraps up this here episode, but stay tuned for next week while we investigate some deeper opportunities in the web department, if you know what I mean.
I don't know.
I do declare.
It's going to be a hootenanny of angle brackets.
I'm going to have a mint julep and discuss the base element.
Oh, I hate the base element.
All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening. Thank you, Web Standards Other Gentlemen, for taking time out of your day and coming to visit the show. Chris, anything else?
ShopTalkShow.com.